Welcome to Girls Gone Hallmark, a Hallmark review podcast. I'm Megan, and I'm a longtime Hallmark movie fan.
I'm Wendy. I'm your former Hallmark hater.
When this episode is over, find more from us. You can follow us on Instagram. We are at Girls Gone Hallmark and at Megan and Wendy.
If you want to talk more Hallmark, jump into our Girls Gone Hallmark Facebook group. We have a great group of people over there. No drama, all fun.
This is the best group on Facebook.
Give us a try.
Is saying something. You might have noticed, didn't mention what this episode's about up top. And that's because we are thrilled to have joining us today Erica Tuvley, whose memorable roles in Holiday Hotline and the Santa Summit made him have to battle himself in our countdown to Christmas bracket. He's also appeared in Hallmark projects that include, but are not limited to, Crashing to the Snow, Love Strikes Twice, and A Christmas Cookie Catastrophe. But in spite of his omnipresence on Hallmark, the vast majority of his roles are for other projects. We're super excited to chat with him today. Welcome, Eric. Thank you for being here.
My friends, that was so professional.
Oh, thank you.
that was really impressive. I'm a little intimidated right now. That's great. Hi, friends.
Hi.
Can I jump in with a quick correction right off the top, though?
Oh, no. Did we do it wrong?
No, no, we're all doing it right because this gives us an opportunity to learn together, and yes, therefore it's never wrong. So nobody beat themselves up. A Tuvley, the last name.
Okay, well,
we're keeping it in.
Said it wrong in many episodes.
Yeah, because at first we were like really butchering it.
And it was me.
And then I saw the phonetic spelling on IMDb, and I thought I was like real hot shit. And I was like, it's a Tuvley. And now that is wrong, too. So yeah. I apologize. I'm sorry.
That is okay. The way the mnemonic device that somebody taught me, because I also struggle to communicate it to people, is, and this is going to sound really self-serving, so please keep in mind, I did not come up with this myself. The Lovely, a Tuvley.
Hey, that's perfect.
That's okay. Pretty good, right?
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Wendy's writing that down.
I am writing that down because I'll forget 2 seconds later.
Well, now I'm definitely never going to forget. I should have asked you before we started recording, but.
Wonderful. No, now, it's too late. We're on the ride and we can't get off yet. And we're here together and that's all that matters.
Committed to audio. Speaking of IMDb, I did read your IMDb bio, which tells me, and I know sometimes these things aren't correct, but according to that bio, you did start off pursuing a degree in education and then switch to marketing, and of course now we know that you're acting. So can you talk about the path that led you to where you are now?
Yeah, sure. Here's my origin story. Both my parents were educators. My mother taught in elementary schools, and my father was a guidance counselor in middle schools and junior highs for most of his career. And so education was just kind of around the house all the time. It was a real priority to them, and so I kind of grew up around it. And when I graduated high school, I was really lucky that, number one, my parents, we were far from well off, but they had prioritized and saved for my post-secondary education. And I managed to get a couple scholarships, and I had no idea what I wanted to do. So I went into education because even though my passion, I was the star of my high school drama class. I say that with my tongue firmly in cheek. My parents were pragmatic. My dad is an immigrant to this country. A lot of immigrant families are they're first generation children. They want to make sure that they're getting a good job because they've worked really hard to come over to this country and don't want to see their children take that for granted or anything. So both of them really stressed, we want you to go to university. You can pursue theater on the side, et cetera. So I went into education with the intention of, and I majored in theater with the intention of being a drama teacher. Okay. I think I took a minor in history because I had a really good history professor in high school or as teacher in high school and found out I didn't really care that much about history when the teacher wasn't that great. But I went into the program in theater and I lasted about 2 years before I just realized it wasn't, teaching wasn't what I wanted to do at that time. So I took a year off and got a marketing job in that time and ended up working in marketing I'm still working in marketing for almost 2 decades now. And I was creative during that time, besides the marketing bent of it, which is a creative industry. You know, I sang for a little while in a past life. I was on radio for a little while. And acting was always kind of the thing that I let go of, but never let go of, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're fast forwarding really quick through this, but a few years later, I was with my wife on a trip to New York, and we went and visited an old high school friend of mine who had met a girl and gotten married and was living in New York with her. And they were both making their living as actors. And they weren't, you know, they weren't household names. They had, but they had an apartment across the street from where David Letterman's studio was, now Stephen Colbert's, and they were in the big city, so to speak, making it. And I remember being on the flight home and turning to my wife and saying, I just gave up. Like, I just gave up. Yeah, that's the appropriate audio reaction. I like that. Thank you. And I was in a class for film and TV a week later. And that's how I got started. And I've been now at this for about 11 years. About four of them have been fruitful. And really, really don't regret the decision.
That's amazing. I actually really love that you realize, like, hey, that's what I want to be doing, and I'm going to go for it. I think that's just awesome to hear, like, another adult talk about, like, making a huge life change like that.
Yeah, it's been a bit of an adventure, and I've tried a lot of things, most of which I was unqualified for, but irrationally confident in trying. And that means that I got to do a lot of cool things, you know, like I just got to do a lot of cool stuff. But this was the one that was always calling. This is the one that was kind of always, you know, burning in the back of my mind. And I felt like I had missed my chance. And I humbly submit that perhaps I haven't, because I'm having a really good time right now.
That's super inspiring.
100%.
I'm like, what? How am I going to apply that to my life? I feel very motivated by you, Eric.
Well,
thank
great.
You very
thanks
much.
For, yeah. Well, thanks for having me. It was great talking
We're
to you
here.
Both.
And we got to go. We got big drink, big plans to make.
Not a moment to waste.
That's right.
That's awesome. So speaking of straight line, like given that your path to being a working actor wasn't a straight line, do you have advice to offer other aspiring actors who maybe are deciding like or revisiting a career or even new actors?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I can't promise it's all good advice, but sure, I'll give some advice. In my case, age and maturity really helped. Coming into this, I think all of us probably feel to some degree that all of us of a certain age probably feel that in their late teens and early 20s, they were some version of a jerk compared to where they matured to. That's very true for me. I don't think I would have handled this industry very well at that age. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the reason that I went down the path that I went down. I think it happened for a reason. There's less desperation now. There's more perspective. I can be pretty rational about an industry that is not merit-based. And I can, you know, take things in stride in an industry where you basically put your heart on the line for every job that you go out there for and get rejected significantly more than you get accepted. It's not a linear path. It's not progressive. You don't take one step and then take the second step. Like, you are back and forth a lot. So I think being older and being able to accept that has really helped. So that age and maturity helps. And I guess that's a long-winded way of saying it's never too late. And then the other thing that I've learned, and it's part of that maturity that I brought to this, is in an industry like this, if you're thinking of getting into acting, it's important to set goals, but it's also important to focus on the goals that you control. So goals like, I'm going to get a job are great to have, but you have no control over that. And there's so many variables beyond your talent and your choices that are going to impact that. So, you know, getting in the room is something to celebrate. Getting invited back from a casting director is something to celebrate. Feeling confident that you went in with a plan of how you wanted your audition to go, and you're starting to consistently walk out feeling like I did the thing I went in there to do, is a goal that you should write down or do, you know, whatever system that somebody uses to kind of track those things and put a little check mark beside, because it's something you control. It's something that you can really see the growth of your own career at. And there's a million things that you do control beyond just getting the job, which you rarely will be able to decide for yourself.
Yeah, I think that's such an important thing to point out that the rejection rate is going to be always so much higher than your acceptance rate.
It can be a real fixation if you do that. If you turn around and say like, success is I got the job or not. And you know, there's tons of sound bites of actors giving advice, but there's one from Bryan Cranston that's in particular where he really emphasizes. You can find it on YouTube, advice for actors. And you know, I go back to it a lot. I send the link to a lot of people who ask me for advice, and I say like, the audition is the job. The audition is the job, and the metric of success is not whether you book it. The metric of success is, did you go in there with a great idea and offer them something that would be your take on the role and walk away feeling like you show them what you got? And then it's in their hands. It's not your responsibility anymore, because they've got a million different variables that you thankfully don't have to concern yourself with. It might lead to you being the right solution for their problem and might not. But you did your job. You showed up and did your job. And it is an unpaid job, unfortunately. But it's part of this industry. It's part of what this industry requires. So,
you know, we've spent all of 10 minutes talking to you, and I'm so glad that we get to ask you the next question, because I've heard a lot of actor interviews, but I haven't heard quite as many who are so introspective about the job. I'd love your perspective on it. So you also work as an audition coach, and I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that part of your job. Obviously, running into that old high school friend kind of was the inspiration to go back to it, but is there someone else in your life who is a guiding force to get you where you are now?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, there's no one person. There's so many people who I've met and have kind of impacted my trajectory, but there's not one person who kind of set it off. Except maybe, the prof in university, when I was still taking education with theater as a major, there was one professor in a performance class that basically, not in so many words, but basically said, you're not a very good actor. And I've since been told, in fact, this year I found out that prof's reputation was not great and was not somebody who should have been teaching, much less somebody I should have listened to. Yeah. But I am, I am a rule follower at heart. And at 19, I felt like if you're the teacher, you must know something. Mm-hmm. And so I took that really literally. And that was part of the discouragement that sent me in a different path. So her trajectory and her feedback to me in that class actually sent me on a 15-year departure from the industry before I came back to it through that friend in New York. So, a little bit of a tragic figure, but that would be the person who I think they're pretty instrumental in my journey. And I don't regret where I landed, even if I would have rather have landed here somewhere with more kindness at the beginning of it. Every audition and acting coach and every workshop that I've taken has taught me something. Even the ones that I went to a class or two and I was like, that person is a nutball. I still walked away with something useful for my career or my approach almost every single time. So the first piece of advice that I give people who decide to take coaching from me is take as many classes as you can with as many people as you can. The ones that don't work for you, you'll still learn something from. And the ones that do work for you, start a timer. Because at some point in time, you will outgrow their advice. And if they're not telling you, hey, I think you need to branch out and maybe we connect again in a little while, but we've gone as far as we both can take this and I want you to keep growing, so let's take a break from each other. If they're not telling you that, there's something wrong, but you have to kind of connect that. Like, not every teacher is right for you, and staying with one teacher isn't necessarily right for people either. The other people who have really influenced how I got here, though, are my wife, who has watched me try a bunch of different careers and get really passionate about things for very short amounts of time until I found this, and has been really patient with all of my attempts and all of the time away or the distractions or the indulgences that my trying everything has brought into the house. And then my agent. I started working with an agent named Alicia Fauché at Element Artist Management just a few years ago. And she is just as invested and as enthusiastic about my career as I am, except she's way more objective. She doesn't take things as personally as I do. She's smarter than me about how the industry works. And any leaps that I've made in the last couple of years, I 100% share those victories with her. She's truly somebody I think of as a partner in my career.
And it's probably easier for her to be objective because it isn't personal to her, right? They're not.
It isn't. Yeah, that's her job. Yeah. That's her job to not only talk me off the ledge if I'm feeling really, you know, in my feelings about something, but also to turn around and tell me when I'm being ridiculous, you know, like to just say, hey, that's not how life works in this industry, buddy. And that's an important voice. I encourage everybody to get an Alicia in their life.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And I think that's a really lovely comment you made about your wife, because reality is it's not the traditional, right? Like your job doesn't fit into a box. You can't predict day to day or week to week what it's going to look like. And so being in a relationship that doesn't support that would not be conducive to success.
No. And she is, you know, she's had my back since I started doing this. And for the first few years, like I kind of alluded to, it wasn't working out great. You know, I was trying hard and I was going out for stuff, but it wasn't coming back in the way that I was putting out, so to speak. And she was still there and she was still encouraging and, you know, and supportive and patient. And yeah, I'm very fortunate.
That's cool.
She's lucky too. I'm pretty good too.
Of course.
But like,
I'm sure she would say that too, were she on this interview. Yeah.
So speaking about going out for stuff, talk to us about how you approach an audition. Like what kind of strategies do you use to stand out to casting directors?
I'm a big fan of knowing the rules and then breaking them a little bit. So, you know, for a lot of years, I was pretty, like I said, I'm a rule follower and I was pretty stringent on basically coloring within the lines, so to speak, on any audition. And then as I got more and more confident, I started taking a few risks. And they're not going to sound like really monumental risks, but having been a coach for auditions, having auditioned a lot, having been a reader in the audition room with casting directors, which is something I recommend every actor do too. If I can throw a little bit more advice in there, if you get the opportunity to read for a casting director, it is the most incredible training you'll ever see, because you really get a sense of what isn't and is working when you're in the room watching 100 people in a day come in and out. Unfortunately, with the industry going more to a self-tape thing, that those opportunities are fewer and fewer to read in the room with people. But if it's available to you, I would recommend it. So the more auditions that I saw, the more I saw that almost, you know, in a lot of cases, a lot of people do the same things. And no matter how solid they are, they start to blend together. So I started playing with things like framing and, you know, where I was in this little box, you know, of a shot, a locked off camera shot, and how I could use the frame to create the space that you're supposed to be in that environment, using, you know, how close or far I am from the camera, whether I enter, whether I dip out of frame and keep talking, just to kind of bring the audience who's watching, the producers or directors who are watching, into a world, even though all they're looking at is as a neutral background, so that they can sense I'm in the space, even if they don't see the space around me. I started playing with props, which is a very controversial thing to talk about when you're talking about auditioning actors. The advice I usually give is do it, but if you need it, like if the casting director asks you to drop it and you have no idea what to do next, you're using it wrong. It should not be the audition. Your folder, your portfolio should not be the thing that gets hired. It should be your performance. And then all actors get these things called breakdowns that kind of describe what the writer or the producer or the director has in mind for the character. And if I read that breakdown and then I read the sides and I say, you know what, I know what they're going for here, but to me it feels instinctually, it feels like I could do something completely different and still give them the result they're looking for, still move the story forward. Then I would just start making choices that are completely contrary to the background materials and live with the decision. It might be entirely wrong for them, but I know it feels right to me. So here's my take. And if you don't like it, then you don't like it. So I highly recommend before people start flaunting those things that they get really, really comfortable with, like I said, the rules, the basics of a strong, technically sound audition. But once you've got that, coloring outside the lines is way more fun. And, you know, not to lead people astray, but those last 4 years where I've started to do more and more stuff and more interesting and diverse stuff, I would attribute directly to taking more risks in the room and just seeing where they land.
It's interesting what you said about things going to more of a self-tape. I imagine COVID accelerated that process quite a bit. And then they realized, oh, this is so much easier, right? As an actor, Do you have a preference? Is it harder to not get that visual feedback, to not have any sense of how things are landing when you just send in a tape and hope for the best?
Yeah, there's a number of reasons that I like in-person better. The first is my neuroses. I will retape a self-tape to an unhealthy degree.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you just want to get it right, right? And there's no such thing as getting it right.
Sure.
Like, I've never solved acting, and I don't know anybody who has. So a self-tape allows you that opportunity. And there is something to the stakes of going into a room where you've got 3 to 10 minutes, usually on the lower side of that, to do your thing, because there's 20 people outside the room waiting for their 3 to 10 minutes, and they're scheduled tightly together. And if you don't nail it, or at least come close to nailing it, the person who's on the other side of the camera has a schedule to keep to, and you might not get a chance again. So, like, knowing that you have to bring it, I think, is a real test of an actor's ability to bring it on the day, because especially in, you know, Hallmark is what has brought us together here today. Those movies are on a pretty accelerated schedule, and you don't often get 10 and 11 takes on a scene. You know, you're lucky if you get a third, because they're shooting in a very compressed timeline. So I think the in-person audition lends itself very well to productions like that. I also think that this job I've chosen is about connecting with people.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, never mind being in the same room as your reader and being able to connect with somebody who's reading opposite you and bringing a scene to life that way. The connection you make with a casting director through an email or a video they're watching on their screen versus actually being able to spend 30 seconds talking to you and getting a sense of who the individual is, I think that's going to be, you know, if the industry continues to go towards the self-tape thing, I think that's going to be a really lost dimension of casting. And I know a lot of casting directors are talking about they miss that. They miss being able to connect with people. So even those that are doing it online or trying to do it live on Zoom or some other platform, to at least have a connection with somebody, even if it is through a machine.
I've been so fixated on the comment you made about how, like, the pressure of getting it in the moment, right? Like, you can't go in and be like, sorry, can I retake that 18 times when you're in the room? I think maybe you lose something also because now you've got this actor on set and all of a sudden they need 77 takes to get comfortable with it.
100%.
You know, you don't really have an idea of how they're going to perform. So that's...
Yeah. Like, I have maybe, at least in my opinion, I have the best job on earth. So I don't mean to turn around and try to gripe about it too much, because I'm extremely grateful for
it. It doesn't read like
it.
That at all. Just
great. Yeah. Wonderful.
Yeah,
so
not
allow
at all.
Me to gripe then.
Yeah.
Self-tapes mask a lot of bad actors, or at least bad habits with actors. And I think you've absolutely nailed it. It's really easy to convince somebody if you've had 20 takes, 30 takes, 70 takes to get it right. It's really easy to convince them that you can get it right because all they're seeing is the one you did right. But, you know, the truth comes out in the wash on the day. And I think that's something that is underestimated in how many tapes you can see in a self-tape environment doesn't tell you how much an actor can pivot when given direction in a moment. And, you know, something will go wrong on camera and you can either start the take again or you can keep going and see if something magical happens that you didn't plan for. And that's, mm-hmm. you know, I work with a director quite frequently. He directed the Santa Summit and Christmas Cookie Catastrophe, among others. I've worked with him probably half a dozen times. His name is Jeff Beasley. And Jeff and I love each other mostly because of the mistakes I've made on camera and him letting it roll. Like, that's, I think, where we get along the best, is where we just find things together in the moment. And he does that with other actors. I don't mean to make myself sound like I'm the only person he plays with like this, but that's that joy of discovery I think you can only have with somebody who can nail it the first time and then give you a couple options for your editing room afterwards.
And well, it's so funny that you said that, because I was just thinking that must be the reason why you look at productions, and we spend a lot of time looking at Hallmark productions, but I'm sure it happens where actors and directors will work with the same people because they know what to expect. I'm going to go where I'm comfortable rather than rolling the dice.
Yeah, there's a few directors that I've had that fortune of working with, but Jeff by far is the person that I've collaborated with the most. And the freedom he gives me, the rope he gives me to hang myself, as the expression goes, is incredible and enviable, and I'm really grateful for it.
That's amazing. I am throwing a curveball at you because I did notice that your bio says that you're an emerging screenwriter, so you wear a lot of hats. Is there one thing you love more than anything, or do you just like to do a lot of different things and try different things?
Yeah, it's acting is the thing for me. Like, yeah, performing on camera in particular is the thing for me. That's where the real passion is. But you can't be in this industry and not get curious about things. I've never really wanted to direct. So that's one thing that's not on there on purpose. I think I directed a couple short films or collaborated with people on that and thought, I don't want this responsibility.
Yeah.
that's a lot of pressure. So that's just not for me. I just don't have that bug. But I do like telling stories. I do like weaving things together. I'm still very emerging in that phrase, is doing a lot of heavy lifting. I make no bones about it. I'm still learning as I go. But in my other life, working in an advertising and marketing agency, I work on the strategy side, and we do a lot of writing in it. And a lot of it is kind of storytelling about brands and organizations. And so I've gotten pretty good at weaving stuff together, and I've started to parlay that into writing scripts, and it's enjoyable, but it's certainly the side hustle to this hustle, you know?
Mm. Yeah. That comment you made about directing makes me think, do you not love directing because it puts you on the spot too much?
Yeah, a little bit. Like I think I get pretty paralyzed when I know somebody else's happiness. I'm mm-hmm. using happiness in air quotes here. You can't see them, but yeah. everybody listening, I hope I'll do them louder. Hang on. Yeah. You get that? Right. When somebody else's happiness depends on me, I start feeling pressure. And obviously in an acting role, like getting the scene right, there's a lot of pressure on an actor to do that. But when lighting also depends, like when the gaffer's also looking at you for direction, when set deck is also looking at you for direction, when the producer's looking for you to be on budget, like all of those things and more and more and more, I don't want that. You know, it's the reason I don't want to be an entrepreneur either. I don't want to know that somebody else is depending on me to, you know, put food on their table. That's just too much for me. I'm just not wired that way.
Mm.
So I've tried to focus on being really good at what I'm good at and being my part in that very big machine.
I asked that question because early on you consider yourself shy. You said, you know, you're a little reserved, but your job requires you to perform in front of an audience. So how do you reconcile those two parts of your personality?
I apologize if this sounds rude in any way. Have you been on set?
No.
Okay.
Yeah,
so
no.
Let me.
We know
let
nothing.
Me that, no. That's great. And I'm asking that sincerely because I think once you, if you've worked on set, you start to realize that when you're on a movie set, very few people in that very crowded room care about what you're doing because they've got their own jobs to do. And so despite there being 100 people gathered around looking in your general direction between action and cut, most of them aren't really looking at you. There's this great analogy. I can't remember. I think it was a talk show appearance by a pretty prominent actor, but forgive me. I don't, if anybody recognizes this, I'm not trying to plagiarize it. I just don't remember who the actor was. But they were talking about how they had a particularly hard scene that they needed to do, and they were really getting angsty about it and working up to it. And they went and performed it. But, you know, because they're on set and everybody's, people don't applaud for you that often on set and say, oh, what a great take that was. Like, that's not the environment it is. So they turned around to somebody who actors work really closely with, which is the hairstylist who was working that day. So as they're getting touches on their hair, this actor turned around to the hairstylist in a quiet moment and said, hey, was that any good? And the hairstylist looked at them and said, with all sincerity, oh, it was perfect. It was wonderful. Your hair didn't move once. And it's such a good... it's such a good like reminder of other people's have other jobs there, honey. So you know, to me, that shyness that I probably felt when I first started stepping into this, knowing that I and my very first roles, and I would get really, really self-conscious about it. As very early in my career, I realized, oh, nobody's really watching me. They're watching the monitor to make sure that the frame is good. They're watching the sound to make sure that we're not getting anything in the background. And like, they're doing their job. It's such a trade position. It's such a like a blue-collar position when you actually look at it from the inside. And so that helps.
Yeah, that's kind of like, I'm highly self-conscious. And my dad used to say, like, in a kind way, it sounds rude, but nobody's thinking about you nearly as much as you think they are.
100%.
Yeah.
Like, that you're just not on their radar in the way that you're worried there are. And I think that is kind of the same concept. Like, you're worried that everyone's watching your every move, and they're like, is the lighting working here?
It's a little bit meta, but when you guys reached out to me and said, hey, we'd love to chat with you, that made me like, you know this from the email correspondence, that made me super uncomfortable because you wanted to talk about me. But if you had reached out to me and wanted to talk about Dasher, I like, you would have gotten a soliloquy, because the work is something I'm not shy about. I'm really proud of the stuff that I've been able to do and when it resonates with people. But when people want to know, you know, what was it like growing up? It's like,
Yeah, I get
that. I feel that deeply. I don't want to talk about myself ever. So I appreciate you being here.
Oh, you know, you guys are so gracious and so funny. And I think I can say this. I think we're all a little disappointed that I wasn't, that not only was I poised to be against myself with Holiday Hotline and Santa's Summit in the bracket, but neither one of me won.
I know that you lost twice. Come on. That's a real hit. I'm sorry.
Come on. Really, like, I think we all felt a little bit of that. I mean, let's face it, me most of all. But
look, this year and last year, and I don't remember it being like this in previous Hallmark years. We've never done the bracket before, but it did seem like there were these two runaway favorite movies. And it's like, I almost want to disqualify them. Not that they weren't fantastic movies, but it's like, you know, it's a foregone conclusion at some point.
Yeah.
I thought, no, but wait.
Yeah,
there's
totally.
All these other movies.
No, it's, you know, it was all so much fun. It was so much fun.
And
I've never been that active on Instagram ever. So thank you. Thank you for that. That was a lot of fun.
We love it. It's a fun. Yeah. And of course, we don't, obviously, there's no, it's a throwaway win. I mean, there's nothing to win. Yay. So it's just fun for us. You mentioned Dasher. We talked about the Countdown to Christmas bracket. We know you best for your roles on Hallmark, but, you know, looking at your resume, that's just such a tiny fraction of what you do. Is there a type of role you like to play more than another?
Well, you know, I'm of a certain age, and I'm still waiting for the call to play Peter Parker or Marty McFly when they reboot the future. You know, my fingers are crossed, but like, come on, it's never gonna happen. I'm way aged past that.
You could do Marty McFly.
You could absolutely play Marty
Honestly,
McFly.
I'm not kidding you here. I just got chills. I think you'd be the perfect
you
Marty
You guys are taking my joke a little too seriously.
No. Look, my husband is the ultimate Back to the Future fan, so I know of which I speak. He watches it on very specific days every year, the trilogy, because of, I don't pretend to know what those days are, but because of when he went back and when he returned. I've seen these movies. I really think that's a goal you should hold on to.
Well, you know what? Thank you. This joke has backfired tremendously. No. please see my earlier comments on self-consciousness. But
nobody is judging you right now, by the way. No one, I guarantee you.
Thank you. But no, let me also say that is a movie that does not need to be redone. It is like, when you talk about a perfect movie, that is up there. There's nothing to revisit with it that it can really improve upon. We would just ruin it. So I don't want to be the person ruining it either. But, you know, my goals have kind of changed from, like, looking at, you know, what kind of role do I want to play? I want to keep branching out. When I started gaining a little bit of traction, and this is less in the Hallmark sphere, I got a lot of doctors and professionals. In fact, I cut a reel recently to make fun of the fact that I've had a number of different jobs giving bad news to people.
Oh, man.
In major motion pictures to be able to set off the story. And that's, you know, it's a wonderful thing to be the unofficial Dr. Bad News in several different movies. I've done that. And I love it when people turn around and say, we want you to do it for us too. Like, I don't take it for granted. But at the same time, every time I get to do a character I haven't done before, I'm excited because I know I've got more to give than than you folks have seen yet. And you don't always get that chance as an actor unless somebody gives it to you. So I'm constantly trying to stretch. I'm constantly trying to do something that I haven't done. Beyond that, I love doing comedy. I'd love to do more of it. I'd love to be on a prestige HBO or AMC drama. I don't have any in particular. My mom was really passionate about, she's no longer with us, but she was really passionate about Star Trek. So that'll be a universe that I chase until I retire from this career for her. But there isn't like a, I don't have a vision board of this kind of role or that kind of role. I'm just excited when something new comes my way.
We have a, on a lighter note, a running segment on our podcast, and we call it the Justice Four segment. And it started with when Maddie Finocchio, who we knew from a project that we did years and years ago, we seek justice for the actors who are always our favorite supporting characters, and we want them in a starring role. And I want to ask you this question, but then I had a thought while I was driving here today that I want to follow up with. So is there an actor, other than yourself, of course, whom constantly plays these supporting role character actors who you'd love to see headline a project?
Let me just clarify, other than myself.
Yes, I mean, you are on 100% on our list. So we have taken up the helm of the Justice for Erica Tevley.
Wonderful. So other than myself, because you guys have decided I deserve. Okay, great. Just wanted to clear that up a little bit.
I mean, obviously, it's Eric. And then after you get your turn, who's next?
Right. After I get my turn. Perfect. I love Maddie, by the way. He's the perfect person to have inspired this. I got to work with him briefly on, what was it called? Made for Each Other. He's a great guy to model this after. Well, let me start with the easy ones. I have a short but specific list. Those of you who have watched the Santa Summit, it will be no surprise that I'm going to throw Stephanie Sy and Amy Groening into that list.
Mm-hmm. They are both amazing.
They're incredible. And for my money, they already did their lead, which was the Santa Summit, because that is a four-person lead movie. Like they, you know, whatever you want to consider them in terms of supporting on a piece of paper, I think the fan response has validated that both of them were leads in that movie and that people want to see more of them in more movies in their own universes. So they're also really great people, everybody. I've dined and gone out with both of them. They're good friends. I fully endorse them.
We fully co-signed that. And in our review of that movie, we said that it should have been marketed as an ensemble cast as opposed to this, you know, romantic pairing. Not that anybody is taken away from, but it really shone as an ensemble.
It really is. And I think, you know, I don't know that this is, I haven't watched every Hallmark movie. I'm sorry.
Neither have we.
But I've watched, well, now you're going to lose followers just for admitting. But I will say that it's the Santa Summit was all credit is due to Russell who wrote this, but The Santa Summit is the first Hallmark movie I've been a part of that is a love story about three women and about friendship being the love, you know. And, you know, my very good friend, Ben Hollingsworth, who is lovely and incredible in that movie, with all due respect to him, his love story was just the icing on the cake and the relationship of those three women. And I think that's indicative of directions that Hallmark is going that I'm really excited about. I was really excited to be part of a movie like that.
Yeah, us too. We've been saying for, I mean, how long have we been doing this? Several years now. But for us, we don't always need a movie that has a romantic relationship attached to it. And that's why we were so drawn to the Santa Summit, because it was about, for us, female friendship. And that is just as important as a romantic relationship.
Yeah, and it's interesting to watch.
Yes. I
mean. Hear, hear.
Yeah.
Like it was lovely. The kiss by the tree was earned and lovely and tear inducing, but man, it was the adventure of finding, and it's the three of them that go on that adventure that I think people really resonate with. So Steph and Amy are the first people. So let me throw other names at you.
Yeah.
Because I think this is fun for me. There's a person, so I don't know this person. I'm a huge fan of a woman named Julie Nolke. She is a YouTube creator and an actor. She was in a TV movie, not on Hallmark, but of the Hallmark ilk called The Wedding Rule. She's a supporting or recurring character on a Canadian comedy series called Run the Burbs. But most people know her from a series of YouTube videos that went viral during the pandemic called Explaining the Pandemic to My Past Self. And if you don't know that series, I would highly recommend Googling it. There's like half a dozen of them. And
I think I can envision it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's basically her sitting across the table from her, explaining to herself 3 months ago what's about to happen in 3 months.
Oh, that's
And as you can imagine, she had plenty of material to go back to. And that's just one series of the body work that she's been putting out for years. She is perfect. If you watched Round and Round, I believe it was called, with Vic Michaelis this year.
Yeah.
She's cut of the same cloth of Vic Michaelis. Vic Michaelis comes from another person I don't know, but I'm a huge fan of. They come from a real comedy background. And they only add a new dimension as opposed to taking anything away. They just add this dimension of real comedy chops to the Hallmark world. And so I think people really responded to Round and Round, I think Julie Nolke can bring that same kind of dimension that Vic Michaelis just did and did wonderfully for people. So I got two more. Is that okay? Okay, great. Phew. And these ones are personal but no less earned. So a friend of mine that I know professionally named Fuad Ahmed. Again, he's been in Hallmark style movies like Not So Royal Christmas. I think he's been in several Hallmarks in supporting roles as well. He's a Pakistani Canadian actor who is gorgeous and ready for that leading man role. He's just fantastic. And there's an Indo-Australian actress named Pallavi Sharda, who was in a Netflix rom-com called Wedding Season, which is must-see TV. It's incredible. It's my favorite of these type of movies that I've ever watched. Again, Hallmark.
That's my list.
It's so good. It's so good. And she's so good in it. As a mixed-race Indian actor, I get excited when I get to work with Indian talent in lead creative positions. When I've worked with Indian directors, when I've worked with Indian leads, I don't get that opportunity a lot. Mm-hmm. And even though I'm very aware of my complexion and how I appear on camera, it resonates with me to see people like my aunts and uncles that I get to work with and see them in those roles. So I would not only throw my support behind them and people who I have worked with, like Nazanin Contractor in A Winter Getaway, but more talent and more diverse talent would be my vote there too in those leading roles.
Yeah, we're always screaming for that. Especially on Hallmark. And Hallmark they're definitely moving in the right direction. And
100%.
And we applaud. I do feel like they are taking steps in the right direction and to stand out against other networks that are deliberately doing the opposite of that.
Yeah, I would agree.
Celebrate that when it happens. But
yeah, I think if you look at the trend line, like, sorry to make this so like nerdy, but if you looked at the graph, of course, it would go up and down a little bit, but it's trending in the right direction in mm-hmm. terms of more representation on screen, more interesting stories. The first movie I worked on back from the pandemic, I'm pretty sure it was the first, was called Crashing Through the Snow.
I loved that movie, by the way.
And it was a blended family movie.
Yes.
Like, it starts on the premise of mom and dad have split up and they're co-parenting. Like, I've never been or seen that Hallmark movie. I've never been in or seen that Hallmark movie. And that was my first moral victory, turning around to the producers who cast my character. I turned around to them and said, hey, can I have an Indian last name like I do in real life? And they gave me one. And like, I don't know if anybody other than me noticed, but I noticed.
Yeah.
And so like that movie is really close to my heart for a number of different reasons, but also because it was, to me, the time that my eyes were opened of how much progress these movies are making, but more importantly, how easily accepted they are by the audience that's actually asking for it. And I'm really encouraged by that.
Yeah, that's a great point about that movie. And the story wasn't about getting mom and dad back together, right?
It was no,
about they lived wow. these two full, happy lives as separate, unmarried parents.
Yes.
And, you know, there was speed bumps along the way, as makes a good movie. But yeah, that was a great movie. And that's a great point about that. I did want to say this. I had, you know, we asked this question about who do you want to see in a lead role? Don't want to take away from the power of a great supporting actor, because I think there's something special about someone like you who can take a role like Dasher and make it so memorable.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, take, you know, another great example, Stephen Tobolowsky, who's one of my favorite people on this planet, who I will never meet. I mean, doesn't ever play a lead role, but is so deeply memorable in his roles. And I think there's something really special about someone who can do that as well. And I don't mean to take away from the power of, you know, these roles that may have less screen time, but are no less important.
So Stephen Tobolowsky, I worked with Stephen Tobolowsky in a movie called Fractured on Netflix. And he's who I was starstruck by in that role. Uh-huh. Because he's been in and has been everything. Like,
yes.
And that's the dirty little secret in probably not just Hallmark, but perhaps especially Hallmark. I get to have way more fun than the leads usually. Like, I get to do things that they would never get away with because you still have to sell a love story. But I get to spend my entire time in a reindeer onesie. Like, that was fun. Like, it was really fun. I get to be broad. When the comedy asks for it to be broad, I get to make a dancing entrance in Christmas Cookie Catastrophe that starts on my feet and works its way up. Like, I get to do things in those supporting roles that I don't know that I would in a lead. So please, Hallmark, I'm not saying I don't want to be a lead. I'm not saying I wouldn't take it. Please, my phone is, I'm waiting. But at the same time, I'm having a blast being the person who steals those scenes when they give me the opportunity to. It's a challenge, and when it works, sometimes it doesn't, but when it works, I'm over the moon to be given the chance.
If you're okay with it, we did have a couple of listener submitted questions, and the first one comes from a name that you might be familiar with, if you're
No.
Speaking of the Santa Summit, one Mr. Russell Hainline submitted a question. And his question is simply, can Dasher appear in other Hallmark movies forming a Dasher cinematic universe?
I am all over this. Here's my real pitch to Hallmark. I think Erica Tubley as an actor should be the connective tissue in the Hallmark cinematic universe. I think that having me play a
like
guy.
Where's Waldo?
Like, Where's Waldo? Absolutely. The Where's Waldo-ness of it all, who just changes jobs every 3 to 6 months and is trying something new. My backstory for Dasher, because everybody loves talking about actors' process. It's the most interesting thing in the world. My backstory for Dasher is he's a doctor. He's got a real job. He does this for kicks, and these ladies are really, like, this is all below his pay grade the entire time. So we could see Dasher in his private practice and in another movie. Like, I just love the idea. I think anytime Hallmark needs a driver in something, I can find the reindeer ears or the reindeer antlers and we can make it happen. I'd be thrilled.
We have another question that is about Hallmark and what sets their productions apart from other productions you've worked on. Obviously, the timeline would probably be one of them.
Timeline is a big one, which has its challenges, but I think it's thrilling. I think for those reasons that I talked about earlier, like to know that you're not going to get 7, 8, 9, 20 takes at something and to know that you're going to nail it and they're going to make it heartfelt and you're going to make it funny and you got to make it, it's got to move the story forward. Like I think there's more of a challenge in that than people might give it credit for. And for all the other craftspeople working on this in every other department, you know, it is a scramble. It can be a scramble. It's enough time. Because we keep getting them out. I remember being on, it was called Love Strikes Twice.
Great movie.
Love that movie.
Fun movie, right?
Yeah.
With the wonderful Katie Schindley and my good friend Marshall Williams and others. But I remember being in that movie and Hallmark had started promoting it while we were still shooting it. And it just blew my mind that they were saying, hey, coming in a few weeks, I think it was maybe a month and a half ago. And I'm like, we haven't finished. I don't know that it's coming yet. It's a trip how wonderfully well-oiled their machine is. But that is certainly something that is different about the Hallmark mechanism. You know, other than that, it feels pretty similar as a job to a lot of other things. You know, it's fun. Everybody working on the team tends to be having a pretty good time. I don't think that's always true of every project, but it's certainly pretty consistent on all the Hallmarks I've worked on is, you know, it's not a bad day at the office when you're working on those.
Are there any upcoming projects that you can talk about right now that you want to share with our listeners?
I think I can. We're about to find out.
Yeah.
I've been fortunate enough to have a recurring role on a comedy series called Acting Good. It's set on an indigenous reserve in Canada. And I play a manager of a store, one of the big city stores that you know operates on these reserves and price gouges people, which is not a funny premise, but believe me, it's a hilarious show. And we start shooting season 3 in about a month. And so I have got the official invitation. For all I know, maybe I suffer a tragic death in episode 1, but at least I'm right now, I know I'm coming back for season 3, and I'm really excited about it. You can find it on, your Canadian listeners can find it on Crave in Canada, and I believe APTN, which is the Aboriginal People's Television Network, which is a North American channel, might be harder to find on your dial, but I believe you can find it in America on that channel. It's a big, broad, fun comedy. I get to have a mustache through 90% of it, and the mustache might have been what got hired, and I was on the mustache's rider. But it's a blast to play, and the cast is fantastic, and I'm really looking forward to it. I can't wait.
I'm, as you're speaking, Googling the APTN because I famously can't figure out how to watch Canadian television. I know it's not actually that hard, and I consider myself fairly techie, but apparently once you pass the age of like 42, 43, the ability to manage those things just goes out the window. So you can get APTN on
wonderful
the Lumi app on Apple TV.
Hey,
friends. Oh great! So, here we go. Thank you for that. I should have done my homework.
Yeah, no, I needed to know that. Hey, in our research, we came across two different birthdays.
I like
for you.
How your voice goes down to in our research every single time. It's really great.
That's because I.
You guys are professionals.
I talk too quickly, and I try and regulate myself every once in a while when I catch myself doing it, but doesn't happen very often. We did come across two birthdays for you, and the only reason, not that everybody's birthday isn't notable, but one of the two is my birthday, and the other isn't. So
I'm rooting for it to be the same.
Now we can cut this out if you don't want people to know your birthday. It is all over the internet. It is either September 18th or 19th.
Oh, it's neither. I'm sorry.
Oh wow! That is wrong in so many places.
Yeah, here's your lesson. Here's your lesson, kids. The internet is full of lies. Also, if you Google me, my friends are having a lot of fun at my expense for this. If you Google me, I think it says that I'm somewhere in my early 30s. And no.
It does say you were born in 1990.
That's yes. Oh, good. I cried good. A little when it said 1990.
We're so old.
No. Friends, no.
Well, that makes me feel a little better. Hearing your career trajectory, I was like, man, you packed a lot into 10 years. No. Well, we do not share a birthday.
No,
that's
I'm sorry.
Very sad. September 19th is the second most common birthday, perhaps in the United States. I don't think they would have worldwide data about that. But anyway,
have you ever looked into why? Like, is there something happening in January that?
Well, September 9th is the most common, and many of the most common birthdays are in September. I suspect it's like a New Year's situation.
Yeah. I think we've said enough.
Yeah. I don't Subtext really want understand. To know being a person born on one of those.
Yeah.
I don't really need to backwards math that one. Well. So why don't you let our lovely listeners know where they can find you when the podcast is over?
Where they can find me, I'm on Instagram at eatavale. That's eatavale. Or you can just search my name. It's not that hard. And that's about it. I'm not really active on any of the other social media. And really, if you follow me on Instagram, you're mostly signing up to follow my dogs and occasionally an acting update or two.
That's what we're here for.
Yeah, totally. We love dogs.
We love dog content.
Perfect.
We cannot thank you enough for being here with us today. This was so much fun. Anybody who knows us knows that I don't do interviews because they terrify me, and this was a blast. So,
well, this terrified me too.
Yes, I told you it would just be a conversation. I thought it. I think that's what it turned out to be. I loved it.
Well,
I learned so much.
Too. You guys made this super easy. I will tell you, I'm only mildly disappointed that I did my hair and then realized this was audio only. But I'm also mostly relieved. You saved me from myself. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for listening to this episode of Girls Gone Hallmark. If you love this podcast, we love your 5-star ratings and reviews. You can leave them in the podcast app of your choice and pop into our Facebook group to talk about how much you loved this interview with Eric. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.